Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways. February 24th, Wednesday. The wind is warm and playful today, boisterously rolling down the hill. Earlier, the cormorant hung piratical to the thrashing Jolly Rogered branches of the oak. And later, the Pillaton rooks wheeled and played upon the air, carelessly flung like heraldic emblems across the perilous sky. This is NB506812, coming to you from a frost-dusted night, lit by the glow of a full ice moon. The kettle's on the stove, I'm about to broach a brand new packet of biscuits. So welcome, and I hope I find you well. Well, this week we've been having a really mild spell, with some of the nights the nighttime temperatures have remained in double figures. But now a cooler river of air is flowing down and has brought some more classic springtime weather. The syrupy warm sun, the champagne clear air, and crisp nights that give the dawn that brittle, fragile feel. It's been great to see your spring-filled photos on Instagram and Twitter. And I've been following those two reprobates on the narrowboat on a whim with their brand new dog, beautiful Bella, who are now on the Peak Forest Canal. Everybody who is anybody seems to be on the Peak Forest Canal at the moment. Is it crowded up there? And I'm aware that it's not necessarily been your first choice to have moved at this point, but it's the result of that frustrating and maddening conclusion of when you find yourself caught between one organization's reading of the COVID restrictions and it clashes with another organization's. But I'm glad it's all sorted itself out and you're in a really beautiful part of the world. And it's lovely to see Bella enjoying the sunshine. Patrick Monsieur dropped me a line on the Nighttime on Still Waters Facebook page and recommended the Canal du Midi in south of France. And yes, it looks absolutely stunning. And has anybody else been down that neck of the woods? It looks, it's not a waterway that I'm particularly familiar with. And thank you to Jason beside the towpath. And yeah, I think it's exactly the right thing to do. And you're right, these things do go in cycles and ebbs and flows. And we shouldn't fear them or be unduly stressed by them. And so you're right, we shouldn't judge ourselves or feel judged by those natural cycles in ourselves. Those drier spells, perhaps even those darker spells, whether they be related to our creativity or our clarity, our energy, our productivity, they're not the indicators of our value, just as an ebbing tide is not a reflection of the value of the sea. So you're right, let's just flow with these natural cycles and let them take their course. I do really love hearing from you and seeing your photographs. So please feel free just to drop me a line or post a picture or two on either the Twitter page, Instagram account, or on the Facebook page, or even just contacting me on email at nighttimeonstillwaters@gmail.com. And also that cringy bit that I hate, please do, if you can, just click on a like button or subscribe, or if possible, leave a review. And that makes all the difference. Right, that's quite enough of that. Oh, and thank you to everybody who has retweeted, reposted links to this podcast. I really do appreciate it. Thank you. These are the days of the whispered spring, and we need them, don't we? There's a definite spring-like quality to the air that is captured so perfectly in the opening chapter of Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows. And like Mole, we've all been beginning to emerge, blinking in the sunshine, and enjoying the feeling of its warmth on our shoulders. Little knots of activity cluster around various boats, paintwork being sanded, engine hatches lifted, a bow door being carefully revarnished to the burbling sound of Radio 4. And it's not just us. The first of this year's lambs cavort and nuzzle on the hill above us, their tiny voices melding with the bleat song that has accompanied us all through the winter. And of course the ducks, who through most of the winter retained their largely cooperative community, have now disbanded and dispersed into pairs, and every nook and cranny under hedges, around the roots of trees felled by the winter gales, on rooftops of sheds and boats, in well decks you can find them. The hunt for nesting sites is on. And above us, the sky is threaded with pairs of ducks. I have found that every year I learn something new. And when I mean something new, I mean learning something important. Something that changes me so that I never see things in the same way again. The world has somehow changed because of it. And it's something that becomes deeply part of me. And each year is characterized by that thing. One year, it was the flower of the clover. Its smell, its texture. I had never realized how common they were. Last year, it was the almost fluorescent quality of purple loosestrife. Another year, it was the impossible intricacy and color palette of the horse chestnut blossom. And another year, it was the depth of yellow of buttercup, so that the entire fields seemed to glow with a warm subterranean light. Sparrows, the character, the sounds and the songs that they make was the revelation of another year. And I can remember being astounded one year by the perfect globe of a dandelion clock. And then not just one, but fields of them. The first year this happened was quite unnerving. I was suddenly struck by the blue of a clear blue sky. And I'd never noticed it before. To be enclosed within a dome of such rich, pure, improbable blue, so blue only a child could pick it. And I think this year, it's an awareness of the duck, and particularly its ability to fly. They're amazing, and I've watched time and time again, totally absorbed in their skill, as pairs of ducks cut across the sky in tight formation, in complete unison with each other. And how, as they come into land, they just drop their tail and one wing to execute a perfect slipping, sliding stall turn, sliding sideways through the air to the earth for the span of one or two wing lengths, reading the air, its strength, its currents, calculated to perfection, before leveling up and then dropping effortlessly into a very tight spot of water. It's incredible. And those times take me back to my childhood when we went as a family to different air shows. And I remember the thrill of watching two Phantom fighter jets roar in low-level unison above our heads. And I get that same feeling as ducks clipper the sky above my head. So solid, so powerful, masters of their airspace. The swans too continue to ply the waters together, and even the moorhens seem more equitable together. The nesting season is certainly here. And as we humans look to spread our wings, itchy to lift our literal and metaphorical mooring pins and go out into the world, our feathered communities, with whom we've shared so much, are looking to settle, to embed themselves within the land, even if only for a few weeks or months. And so we now regularly keep a check on our boats, the planters and fenders that might offer and yield a viable nesting spot. The Canal and the River Trust have sent out the reminder that it's against the law to damage or destroy or even disturb a nesting bird with unlimited fines and the possibility of a 6-month jail sentence. It wouldn't be the end of the world if it happened to us. It'd actually be quite nice to watch and participate in that part of their lives. But to some, particularly those who are continuous cruisers and who have to move on, it can be catastrophic. The movement of a boat is forbidden, and depending on where the nest is, even using your engine to generate power and charge your batteries is also forbidden. If you run out of water or need waste disposal, then you need to seek alternative accommodation. Legislation governing this is even stricter than that of lockdown. And on my bookshelves and the almanacs and the country calendars, I find lists of wild fowling season, of shooting and hunting. We humans are a strange mass of contradictions, aren't we? But of course, we know that spring isn't really here. Our climate in the UK has always played us this way. I say played us, but perhaps it's really gifted us. The poet John Clare seemed to know this. If you read his section on February in his poem, The Shepherd's Calendar, you might be surprised in how bucolic, how upbeat it all is. Uncharacteristically Clare. And if ever there was a poet in the modern era that lived close to the land, it was John Clare. He knew and recorded its brutishness, the scars it can leave on the body and mind, its unadorned cruelties and dispassionate arbitrariness, as well as its beauties and joys. And it was his dispossession of this land through the injustice of the enclosures that forced the eviction of the poor like him from the land upon which they not only lived but were organically part of, as part of him as his skin and bone and the pulsing blood through his veins, that was one of the main factors that broke him, sending him into the lunatic asylum, a true exile of everything he knew and understood and could express in words better than any of the other romantics of his time. And we might expect Clare's February to be dull and grey and brutal, but instead he fills it with life and song. He begins with, "The snow is gone from cottage tops, the thatch moss glows in brighter green, and eaves in quick succession drop, where grinning eyes
once hath been, pit-patting where a pleasant note, in tub set by the cottage door, and ducks and geese with happy joys douse in the yard pond brimming o'er. The sun peeps through the window pane, which children mark with laughing eye, and in the wet street steal again to tell each other spring is nigh. And then Claire goes on to pour into February sunlight and warmth. It's peopled with whistling ploughmen, singing milkmaids, and even their bovine charges frolic, tossing the molehills. And the village streets ring with the laughter of play of children and the chattering gossip. The world has come alive. And as if even Claire himself is taken up in the play, for a while we see spring not through his eyes or even the other characters that fill his world, but through the eyes of a dog, dazzled by the myriad sights and sounds and smells bursting around it. Gnats dance, bees hum, flies abound. He goes on, a calm of pleasure listens round, and almost whispers winter by, while fancy dreams of summer sounds, and quiet rapture fills the eye. The sun beams on the hedges lie, the south wind murmurs summer soft, and maids hang out white cloths to dry around the eldon's skirted croft. Each barn's green thatch reeks in the sun, its mate the happy sparrow calls, and as nest-building spring begun, peeps in the holes about the walls. The wren, a sunny side, the stack, with short tail ever on the strunt, cock gadding up above its back, again for dancing gnats will hunt. The gladdened swine bolt from the sty, and round the yard in freedom run, or stretching in their slumbers lie, beside the cottage in the sun. But all these lives, human and non-human, know, as Claire himself knows, and as we, in our own tentative spring, also know, this is really just a brief succession of winter. The cold will return. Claire concludes February with, thus nature of the spring will dream while south winds thaw, but soon again frost breathes upon the stiffening stream and numbs it into ice. The plain soon wears its merry garb of white, and icicles that fret at noon will eke their icy tails at night beneath the chilly stars and moon. Nature soon sickens of her joys, and all is sad and dumb again, save merry shouts of sliding boys above the frozen furrowed plain. The foddering boy forgets his song and silent goes with folded arms, the crudling shepherds bending low, crouching to the whizzing storms. Yes, no doubt the world will shrink again as the cold bites once more, and we may once more crouch into those bitter winds, but we now know it won't last forever. This is not so much a false spring as a promise, a whisper, an encouragement, a chance to recharge our batteries for the year to come, to plan again, to look up and outward, eye to eye with the coming year. And this feeling, this prompt of spring before its time, is captured beautifully in Edward Thomas's book In Pursuit of Spring. Thomas is trapped in London in the late winter of 1913. And he was trapped not just geographically and environmentally, but the stress of his work is impacting on his family life and particularly his marriage with Helen. For very different reasons, Thomas, like Claire, was exiled from the land that was part of him, And he was caught and trapped in the winter of the soul as much as the winter of the seasons. And his book, In Pursuit of Spring, is his account of his bicycle ride to the West Country to greet the first arrival of spring, a spring that was as existential as it was natural. And his first chapter describes his preparation and his reasons for this ride. And he writes, "Perhaps it was rather more than a month before Easter that a false spring visited London. But I'll go back first a little earlier to one of those great and notable days after the turn of the year that win the heart so without deceiving it. The wind blew from the northwest in such peace and energy together as to call up the image of a good giant striding along with superb gestures, like those of a sower sowing. The wind blew and the sun shone over London. A myriad roofs laughed together in the light. The smoke and the flags, yellow and blue and white, waved tumultuously, straining for joy to leave the chimneys and the flagstaffs like hounds sighting their quarry. The ranges of cloud bathing their lower slopes in the brown mist of the horizon had the majesty of great hills. The coolness and sweetness and whiteness of the foam on the crests of the crystal fountains, and they were burning with light. The clouds did honour the city, which they encircled as with heavenly ramparts. The stone towers and spires were soft and luminous as old porcelain. There was no substance to be seen that was not made precious by the strong wind and the light divine. All was newly built to a great idea." He goes on a little further on. "So far, the life of men moving to and fro across the bridges was like the old life that I knew, though down below upon the sparkling waters many birds were alighting or were already seated like wondrous blossoms upon the bulwarks of a barge painted in parrot colours, red and green. When would the entry begin?" And again, Thomas, like Claire, knows that this is just a brief respite. And the wind swung round the compass rose and the winter returned. But it was enough. Enough to light that fire in him. To lift the eyes. To raise the shoulders. And to borrow a phrase from another Thomas, Dylan Thomas, to light that green fuse that drives the flower. And this year, this winter, perhaps more than any other winters, we need these times to replenish, to reinvigorate, to remind us of the songs of all of those woods and fields we have yet to discover. And with that, the fireside dreams of winter begin to grow and develop into the plans for our tomorrow. And talking of firesides, the stove needs a stoke, and outside the clouds are beginning to disperse, the temperature dropping and a frost is forming, the mist is rising from the canal, and it's time for me, I think, to say goodnight. So this is Narrowboat 508612. Signing off for tonight and wishing you a very peaceful and warm and safe night. Good night. Temperature outside 1.3 degrees. Inside 26 degrees. Humidity 94%. Dew point, 1 degrees. Wind direction, northeast. Wind strength, 3 miles per hour. Barometric pressure, 1040.6. rising. Precipitation, nil. Moon phase, 99.6%. Waning gibbous. Day length, 10 hours, 47 minutes. Sunset, 17:43. Sky casting, 6:54.